Women's Centre at Victoria Trades Hall ran a conference this week down at the CFMEU buildings, posing the question, should there be an Icelandic-style women's strike to get equal pay for women, to call for the sharing of the caring roles equally across society, and to declare enough is enough when it comes to workplace gendered violence. In this program, we bring you some of what happened. First up, Michelle O'Neill, ACTU President, spoke.
So it's nearly International Women's Day, and when we were talking about what I was going to say this morning, Will and I had a chat about it the other day, and we were talking about, given what you're going to be talking about the rest of the day, let's try and unpack a bit what really mobilises women to take action. Like, what are the things that actually get women moving, make us feel like that we can fight back, make it must feel like that we can make a difference? So that's what I'm going to do, and also talk about how we as women unionists can do that in a way that is genuinely inclusive, that really does organise and mobilise working class women, women of colour, Indigenous women, women who may be discriminated against in all sorts of ways, making sure that whatever action we take, we don't assume or organise it in a way where it's only going to work for certain groups of women. So how we take action, what mobilises us, and how we make it as strong and inclusive and broad and powerful as it can possibly be. So because it is International Women's Day this week, I want to start by talking about International Women's Day, of course, because it was proudly for me, having come out of the union that I'm from and a proud member of, it was garment workers in New York who took to the streets in 1908, that was the very beginning of International Women's Day. And they were women who were fighting for some basic things. They wanted to fight for shorter hours, they wanted to fight for better pay, and actually wanted to fight for voting rights. And it was their courage in taking to the streets and workplaces that were hard, dangerous, dark, oppressive places. You remember, this is 1908, and it was 1911 that the famous Triangle Shirt Fire took place, where 150 odd women died in a fire in one of these very same garment factories. So it was women in those sort of workplaces who walked out, took to the streets, and demanded a better deal. And of course, once one factory walked out, they were joined by many others. And that was the very first, the following year, IWD in New York, that honoured and recognised that action of the garment workers. But you know, 28 years earlier, down the road from here, so 28 years before that, a group of garment workers at a place called Beef Shice, which was a garment factory here in Melbourne, took action. So they stopped work. They walked out. They walked out because their workplaces were unsafe. They walked out because the company was trying to cut their piece rate and pay them even less than the work they were money they were getting. They walked out because they'd had enough. And that one factory, of course, grew to many other factories that joined them. So this is our living history. This is the history of Melbourne, of Victoria, of Australia. And we were, of course, those brave women then went on to form the very first women's union in this country, which is, of course, now one of the forming unions of what is now the Construction, Forestry, Maritime, Mining and Energy Union. So it's a good, good history to remember. And my experience of being a union official with the Textile Clothing and Footwear Union and active in that union for a very long time is that that story of courageous women taking action, often to the surprise of not just their bosses but the union officials, is one that has continued in that industry and that sector for many years. Again, here in Melbourne in 1932, a group of women at Yarra Falls, which was a textile mill that is now posh apartments down on the Yarra River, which I still remember as a textile mill. And when I was in there, you know, which was many years after 1932, I'm not that old, that it was a Dickensian sort of place. Like it was, I remember the shock of walking into that place for the first time, particularly at a night shift, and how cavernous and dark and extremely bad the conditions were. So, but in 1932, I can only imagine what it was like. And 700 women at Yarra Falls, so we're talking about the Depression here, 700 women at Yarra Falls stopped work, took action, because the bosses there were trying to cut their pay by 15%. And that was it. That was enough. Now, they fought, but they fought at that time not really with the strong support of their union, because the union officials didn't really have the same view. So they went back after a while, but then they went out again because they then got joined by women that were in Geelong and in Ballarat and eventually women in Tasmania. And so the spread of that action of those women saying, no, this is not all right, we're going to fight back against this injustice, was powerful. Despite the sort of views of the officials at the top, you couldn't stop the spread of those women saying, enough's enough, we're going to fight back. So we do have a history we should remember, and of course there's plenty of other examples and many of you in the room will know it, but I also want to recognise that, you know, here, it was here in Melbourne that in 1986 that we had nurses on strike for 50 days. And so our story of teachers, of nurses, of workers in the garment sector, of workers in every industry, if you think about it, you know, the women in the community sector who were part of winning nationally here, the action that they took to win equal pay 10 years ago now, to win equal pay, a massive victory, the only victory under the current set of laws we've got that actually has delivered huge increases in pay for women that in that sector. And, of course, the Big Steps campaign where we see early educators time and time again over the last few years, stepping out, like stopping, walking out, being on the street saying, look at us, we look after kids, we look after children, and look how much we're paid, look how undervalued we are for the work that is some of the most important work you could ever do. So we should feel very proud of the history of women and women's capacity to stand up globally, but very much so here in our own city and state. So, and as you know, we've got a massive campaign going on at the moment with Change the Rules. So we're in the midst of a fight that is about trying to fundamentally get rid of this government, of course, because they care nothing for working people, have no regard for working women, no regard for delivering power and justice and equality for workers. But, of course, our campaign's not about changing the government. Our campaign is about changing the rules, because it's not about you have an election, you think it's done, and don't think it is done, by the way, because there's still, you know, probably 11 weeks to go and anything could happen. But we must change the government and then go on to change the rules, because it is so critical that we do something about inequality in Australia. And that's what's at the absolute heart of the Change the Rules campaign, inequality. And when we look at our demands, I'm really pleased to say to you that the union movement has come together and put the rights for working women, changing the rules for working women, at the very core of the demands of the Change the Rules campaign. I've seen union-wide movements and campaigns in the past where the issues that affect working women are a bit of a tack on. Oh, we better do something about that. And there's an extra issue or two at the end, or, you know, people talk about, oh, and we'll do this. That's not the case in the Change the Rules campaign. The issues that are absolutely at the heart of it, as I said, are the things that are going to make a difference for women. Because if you look at fighting to win a living wage instead of a minimum wage, it's of course women who are predominantly stuck on award pay. I read something this week about, in fact, women who are on award wages, 75% of those women are working part-time or casual. So not only are we stuck on the lowest pay, we're also much more likely to be in insecure work, much more likely to be work that is casualised or contracted out to wherever you are. And so that notion of, at its core, winning living wages, winning changes to insecure work, so we actually can have more secure jobs. So we go back to the notion of genuine casual rather than this crazy idea that you can be a permanent casual forever or contracts that never end. Winning those changes are absolutely critical in our campaign, and changing our bargaining system in a way where we can bargain across sectors and industries so that we can bargain for all women and all workers rather than, again, it's women that are more likely to be in small workplaces, in places that it's much harder to have bargaining power if you're only trying to bargain enterprise by enterprise. So being able to bargain across a sector or multi-employers, of course, is going to give us more power to do something about the conditions that hold women's rights back. So it is good to know that our campaign is one that has at its core rights for working women. And I could mention many other things about it. But I'm going to keep going with really what we're trying to get to the nub of today about what mobilises women. And the things that I mentioned earlier about the industry that I came from, I just want to say to you that when I looked at what was happening in the textile, clothing and footwear industry, and we fought for the rights of our workers, and we looked at what was happening with contracting out and long and complex supply chains where we would find at the bottom of those chains women that were working at home alone and paid outrageously low pay and conditions. We would tell that story 20, 25 years ago and people would go, that's terrible. Shocked by it, shocked by the exploitation, by the effect of that rampant globalisation that really just put profit above everything else, only care about the brand, pay no attention to the result of that, what that means for working people here in Australia and around the world. But now that I'm at the ACTU and I've spent a bit more time talking to other unionists and women in every different sector, every different industry, every town and city that I've been to, that story is everywhere. So that story of insecure work, of what it's like to have jobs that were reliable jobs, where you knew how much you were going to earn day to day, week to week, month to month, has disappeared. So it doesn't matter if you're working in higher education. I've met, you know, people that are lecturing at universities. A woman here in Bendigo who had 12 consecutive annual contracts. So no leave in that time. 12 contracts in a row where, you know, that's the end. You finish up in, what is it, November or something. Well, you get another one in February or March. Nothing in between. I don't know what you're meant to live on. And, of course, so it is in education. It is in health. It's in aged care. My wonderful mum passed away about 6 weeks ago, and I saw firsthand the work that those women who were caring for my mum in a nursing home were doing and what it was like, you know, how hard they worked, how much they cared for her and for us over that time. But, you know, of course, those jobs, so many of those people were working casual and insecure work. They didn't know how many shifts they were going to get. They didn't know how much they were going to earn. And here they were doing something that, you know, was the most important thing, caring for, you know, our dying elders, and they didn't even know that they had even the most basic job security, let alone proper pay and conditions. So this is now a scourge that's gone everywhere, and of course it whacks women the most. So we are fighting to change the rules, and it is something that is entrenched in our system, but I've got a lot of confidence that we can do that, because I think that we've got a pretty broad campaign, but we've also got a campaign that is mobilising people. It's mobilising people in a way that I don't think reckon we've seen the union movement as united and mobilised for a very long time. And we've got a capacity to actually make a difference, but we do have to stay disciplined about it, and we do also, I think, have to make sure that we don't let our passion stop, that we have to keep driving it till we see the difference. And I think Will said something about laws not being enough. She is so right, because you can win the very best laws. Let's say we get rid of the rotten government. Let's say we keep Labor to the promises they've made and we make sure that we get them delivered. And let's say we get it through a crazy Senate, because it will be crazy. Whatever the best result we get, we're still going to have to deal with that Senate. Let's say we win all of that. You know what makes a difference to laws? breathing life to them in workplaces. Because you can have the very best laws in the world, but if you don't feel like you have power, if you don't know you've got rights, if you don't know how to take collective action to enforce those rights, then of course they're as good as, you know, a screen on a computer, or they're as good as a book on a bookshelf. So what mobilises women? Well, I reckon what mobilises women is getting to that point of the final straw. So when I think about what I've seen happen with women that I've been part of fights and struggles with and organised with and fought alongside, it's injustice that mobilises us. It's that sense of the tipping point of injustice, of being undervalued, of being expected to put up with it. And we will put up with it for a certain period of time, but something tips us over. And I reckon often it's the least expected thing that is the tipping point. Sometimes, from my experience, it's not the lack of a pay rise or pay equity, it's the fact that the boss is timing you when you go to the toilet. And then that's the bit that says this is wrong. That's the sort of final straw, if you like, that goes, no, that is so wrong and disrespectful and so lacking in, you know, all the most basic dignity for us. And then you're fighting about everything, of course. You're not just fighting about stopping being timed going to the toilet, but, of course, then you're also fighting for your pay and your better conditions and your rights and dignity. But I don't think we should ever underestimate that it is that, what is the tipping point? What is that final injustice that gets women mobilised? I reckon it's about tapping into our reservoir of rage. You know, like we've got this sort of burning reservoir that, you know, often we keep a lid on, but then something taps into that. And so I suppose the first thing I say, if we're going to mobilise women, is about finding our common experience. And again, thinking a little bit about Melbourne. And of course, one of our claims in the Change the Rules campaign is about winning 10 days paid domestic violence leave for women. And of course, that's just about saving lives. That's what that's about. Why should you have to choose in 2019 between your pay or your job and your safety? But thinking about, again, what gets us, and it is, you can't go past the horrific murders of Jill Maher, Eurydice Dixon and A.R. Masawari. So in, you know, this year with A.R., in last year only with Eurydice, and in 2012 with Jill, young women walking our streets. So what you saw in response to those horrific rapes and murders was mainly women wanting to honour those women, but also wanting to take that public step, not just quietly rage about it, but take that public step to say, no, you know, we're not going to stand for this in our streets and our communities. So that power of, and of course we were joined by many good brothers and comrades in that, but that power of women saying, no, we want a public recognition, publicly to say that this is something we are not going to accept, that this is our reservoir of rage tipped over. That took to the streets and to those vigils in response. So the second thing I would say, as well as tapping into the common experience, is that we need to have a unifying demand. I mean, that was a demand for safety, the right to walk our streets without fear. So that sense of there being a unifying demand is the other thing that gets women moving. So we've got a common experience, something that tips us over, we've got a unifying demand, but then, of course, how do we do it in a way that's most powerful? So I reckon being engaged wherever people are at, wherever women are at, don't assume everybody's ready to be at the front, because the best type of action The best type of mobilising is where there's a role for everyone and those roles are different. We're not the same. We're good at really different things. And being at the front is only one small part. It's not the most important part. It's not the most important part. So having a role and a part to play and a way of engaging women that gives whatever wherever they're ready to be active, gives them a role to play, I think is really important. Building the sense of being in it together, building the collective, instilling confidence and belief. Like I think about the, you know, people, mainly women, but some men too, who had belief in me at times when I thought, I can't do that. Just that simple message, the person alongside you saying, you can do this. You can do this. You can, you know, we're with you. I know you've got this. Like the power of that, instilling belief and confidence in women, is so important. And of course, bravery. You know, being prepared to have women that go that extra step. I know Robin's here, and we're going to hear about the fantastic fight of the women at BHP in the 70s and 80s. And you know, that courage to do something that no one else has done, and go, yeah, we can do this. You know, just because it's never been done before, don't let that stop you. And, of course, that's about knowing the power of the collective and not being alone. So I do want to say to you that we don't have to look far for what will mobilise us. We all know the issues. But what we have to look hard for is how we do that in a way that's going to be open and inclusive and genuinely mobilise all. That we're going to respect activism in all its forms. I want to say to you that every single act of defiance, every single act of defiance is worth acknowledging and recognising. That the best actions are the ones that build to the next and the next and the next. Not the ones that burn out in a blaze of publicity once off. The very best actions build a movement. So, sisters, I want to end with that. I want to say that we are warriors. We are fearless. We are going to change the rules. And happy International Women's Day.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
You're listening to 3CR. Happy International Working Women's Day. We are bringing you some excerpts from the Women's Conference held on Tuesday, March the 5th this week. The question that was being posed by the conference was, should there be a women's strike? Pia from the Women's Equality Office at the Victorian Trades Hall introduces the first panel.
So, right here we have Nahid Parija, the organiser at the Migrant Worker Centre at Victorian Trades Hall Council. Next we have Putri Nazeri, who is an organiser at the NUW. She's an organiser in the farm team and had previously worked in the citrus industry in Griffith in New South Wales and was also a union delegate at a celery farm in Mornington. Next I have Meredith Peace, Victorian Branch President of the AEU. So Meredith had joined the union as a student and quickly became active at her school and was active in the sub-branch's efforts to improve the school's consultative committee and was elected sub-branch president in her second year, then progressed to branch council and in 1990 to branch executive. And in 2001, Meredith was elected as deputy vice president of secondary, and the rest is history. After that we have...
On the National Compliance Officer.
Yeah, I don't know how we got that there, sorry.
I am an assistant secretary as well.
Okay, great. And National Compliance Officer. So Beth's role entails the compliance team auditing the supply chains of organisations that apply for Ethical Clothing Australia accreditation. And this ensures that all workers, including out workers, are paid correctly and receiving their lawful entitlements and are working in a safe environment. And then Lisa Fitzpatrick, the Victorian State Secretary of the ANMF. Lisa was elected the Australian Nursing and Midwifery Victorian Branch Secretary in 2001 and has been a strong advocate for nurse-midwife-patient ratios as the solution to ensuring that Victoria has a qualified nursing and midwifery workforce and high standards of patient care and safety. And she successfully lobbied the Andrews government to make ratios in Victoria law. All right, I'm going to start with Poutri, actually.
Oh,
Poutri, can you tell us, can you tell us about a time you have when you might have taken strike or industrial action, and what was it about and why?
Yeah, hi everyone. Good to see you all here. Thank you for inviting me. And my journey was starting in 2016, where I started work in farms August 2016, picking oranges. And most of the farms don't have toilets. Yeah, it's very hard for us, especially a woman, you know, when we got period and heavy menstrual. Yeah, after I moved to Bankstown, it even worse because the farm is too far from our house. It takes like 45 minutes. And yeah, most of the farms, the toilet is far, and sometimes no toilets. And in Bainsdale, we work with a cash contractor, which it's very hard for us to deal with the contractor because they control everything. So when they control everything, even our accommodation, transportation, so that means they control our lives as well. Yeah. At that time, I think I am a very angry person, or so. We work very long hours, night shift, and when I couldn't like go and pee around the bushes. No, not me. And I will force my contractor. No, you have. If not, I will stop the work, and I will ask all the girls to stop as well. That situation, you know, everyone understand that, and I will force my contractor, no, you have to get into the toilet, all of us, before we start the next row. So yeah, what can he do? No pickers. If no toilet, no pickers. It did work, and we got the toilet. Yeah. Not even end there. It even happened in factory as well, when there's a toilet. But when we work long hours, and most of us, majority of our site is all girls, because we're packing celery bunch in Mornington. So when we work long hours, some of us have kids, children. And the company didn't tell us when is our finish time. We start at maybe 5 or 6 a.m. in the morning, and we wouldn't know whether it's we finish at 6, 7 or 8. But we have experience, we finish at 10 o'clock. So yeah, it's pretty bad. And I did as well when this one guy, forklift driver, said, "Oh, if you want smoko, then you go and ask the boss." I said, "All right, okay." I said, "I will do that." And then because none of us, they are afraid of losing their job. But for me, if not because of us, there wouldn't any production in the company, you know. So yeah, I will ask the boss. I will. And I went back to the office and, "Boss, we need smoko. If you want us to finish the pallets, or you want us to finish at 10 o'clock, give us smoko right now." And then he said that, "Oh, don't panic. Let me think about it first." It didn't went good, but after that, the next day, we stopped the machine, passed the machine, and then I wrote 3 pages of letter that we want 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. You know, at that time, we didn't have a fixed time for smoko. We didn't have a finish time, and depending our wages for 1 month, and no superannuation. So yes, if you want us to do your work, so give us these things. So it went good and well. Lucky me, I have union. Yeah, but I don't care if they want to sack me or not. Yeah. So that was my story. The important thing is we have to keep in touch together, support each other, trust each other, and stood voice out and strike with action. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
This is Stinky and you're listening to 3CR's 24 Hours of Female Voices on International Women's Day 2019.
Question, or have you got any thoughts to add to that question about time when you might have taken strike or industrial action, and what was it about and why did you do it?
Sounds pretty pathetic really after that. We've had problems with having toilets so and those basic things. So we're a heavily organised union in the workplace, particularly in the public sector. So I was a young nurse, 25 years of age, and was out on strike in 1986 for 50 days. And I did that because I think there was a number of reasons. I had close friends who were involved in the union, so I was informed and knew about what the issues were, and that was very critical. And it was pretty exciting, actually, to be part of the action. So there was a great sense of camaraderie. It was disappointing because there wasn't obviously enough of us out on strike, because if there was more, then we wouldn't have been out for 50 days. It was very tough, not so much for me. I didn't have children or other family that were dependent on me. I was footloose and fancy free, living at home, well, in my brother's house for no rent. And, so that was handy. And my mum and dad sent me down money from time to time to help me out. But yeah, so that was very big for me, and I think probably got me wedded to the ANMF. And from that time, or before that time, I was involved and I was a student rep. And but yeah, sort of I got the what we call across the road as the ANMF disease after that, and it's not terminal. It's just it's a good one to have. So that was my sort of opening, I guess, and the sort of awakening that I experienced.
Thank you, Lisa. That's my next question, which I'll direct to Nahid. Do you see mass industrial and strike action as the most effective way to bring about changes for working women?
Can I answer the first question as well? No, I didn't have a strike in my life because it's not legal. And we don't have the right to strike, so I didn't have it. But the answer for your question, I think, is yes. I think it's the most effective way to organize and to smash patriarchy and capitalism together. My experience, I used to work in a bakery, a big factory actually, as a baker, first as a packer and then as a baker. So as I said, I wasn't involved in any strike, but I had the experience of organizing the workplace and how you can see the sexist and misogynist attitudes of your workmates can change by the process of organizing. Like, I needed to beg my boss to put me in production line, so I didn't want to be a packer anymore. And it took me 8 months to convince them I want to be in production line, and they were like, no, you are a woman. So the atmosphere in my workplace was so misogynist. And we all know the misogyny in racial and racist workplaces is higher, because when, like, this is a very simple comparison between unions. Like, here we are from NUW and we are talking about not having toilets or other stuff. And who are workers in NUW? We are migrants, we are refugees. So it's a very obvious difference between the workers and how they are excluded from the services and the privileges of other unions and other workers, when we all have to have the same workplace rights and knowledge of our rights. So I think in the process of organizing the workplace, that was the very obvious thing for myself, that I was seeing people that they were attacking me before before organizing the workplace. After that, they were seeing me as the same mate in the same fight. So the level of misogyny and sexism just goes down and they start trusting me. So I think a strike is the most effective way of organizing because of the process. The process is very liberating. So by the process, workers just grow up and they get the knowledge of why collective action is important. So they get the confidence back. And I think confidence is very important because we are taught that we need to compromise all our lives to survive and to live our lives. And we cannot imagine if we one day we want to decide to stop our involvement in the process of ruining this world and this planet and not being the process of capitalism, we just can't. So this is not a decision that we can make. So we want to stop our contribution to the system. We want to be out. We can't do that. So by all this, our involvement in this systematic problem and discrimination, when you just learn and when you just get involved in the process of organizing and start trusting your workmates, it's very important. Like, you just go out and trust each other. No one is going to betray you. No one is going to cheat you. Everyone trusts each other rather than trusting unseen systematic thing that we don't see them as ideology, but they exist, but we just don't see them, but we see each other. So I think, yes, strike is the most effective thing because this is our bodies that we are just chain each other to go out and to do something against our boss. And if we just don't leave, we don't move, so this is a very famous saying, we just don't notice our chains. And again, by noticing all these things and trusting and getting back the confidence, I think we can organize, yes.
Sound a little bit like Lisa, and like the nurses, we're probably in a pretty privileged position in our industry, if you like. We have a very heavily regulated workplaces, so that certainly we don't deal with, as Lisa said, the kinds of issues that you're talking about, thankfully. Albeit some of our members do say from time to time they've not got time to go to the toilet because they're too busy. I don't want to diminish your fight just to get basic, what are really basic human rights. Look, absolutely, strike and industrial action have a place. And, you know, we've got a long history in the AU and our predecessor unions in education in using strike action and also other forms of industrial action to achieve what we want to achieve for not only all of our members, but in certain circumstances, our women members. But I don't see it as the single answer to achieving the things that we want to achieve. There are a whole raft of things that we do as a union to progress the kind of issues that we want to progress on behalf of our members and to achieve those wins that in the past have been really important and will continue to be. To give you some examples of those, you know, in 2012 and 13, we probably had some of our biggest industrial action or strikes that we'd had in our history in the school sector, where I think on one occasion we had 15,000 members at a rally at the tennis centre. That was kind of a peak moment, and like Lisa, that was a big battle against the Baillieu and Napthine governments. But at the same time, we also had a range of other industrial action in place. I think, and some of my colleagues here will chuckle at this, probably one of the most successful bans we've ever put in place, which we were actually very nervous about using, and that was a ban on reporting on student progress. We banned school reports. We copped a lot of flack for it, but our members loved it. I actually think it's had some long-lasting impact on reporting processes, at least in some schools, but we, of course, knew we would cop a lot of flack from parents, and we copped a lot of flack from Baillieu and then, I think, yeah, Baillieu and then Napthine. But what was really important, which was separate to the industrial action or in tandem, is that we do a lot of work where we try and use the media as a form of campaigning as well. And at that time, we ran, and we, as I said, we're in a privileged position. We were able to afford to do this. We have a big membership base. We ran paid TV ads pointing out that Ted Baillieu had broken his promise to make teachers the highest, Victorian teachers the highest paid in the nation. And we had him on tape. And we used that footage relentlessly in TV ads, Ted repeatedly saying, you know, Victorian teachers will be the highest paid in the nation. We also did a lot of work in terms of that advertising around trying to find ways to educate parents, because our biggest stakeholder group in education really are our parents, and we need to have them on site. So we need them to understand the connection between what we're fighting for industrially from an educational perspective, because our conditions impact greatly on the education we're able to provide our students, whether that's in TAFE, early childhood, or schools. If we have massive class sizes, we can't meet the needs of our kids within those classrooms. If our workload is out of control, we don't have the time to spend on the most critical work, which is about the work inside our classrooms. So we've done a lot of effective work on that front, finding ways to advertise, finding stories in free media where you're getting journalists interested in issues to make sure you're talking to the community about why we're having this battle and why it is so important for their children that we actually win. So strike action, industrial bans, those kinds of things absolutely have their place, but they've got to be part of a much broader and much more strategic campaign that has a whole lot of fronts, because you won't necessarily win using one tactic alone. In fact, I would say you would never win using one tactic alone. You have to use a whole raft of different tactics to achieve what you want to achieve.
Great, thank you. Yeah, this question's for you. Do you see any barriers or challenges for working women in engaging in mass industrial or strike action?
Well, I've been in the industry since the early 70s as a worker and worked in large and smaller workplaces. Most of our membership is from a very diverse group of non-English speaking background, predominantly women. And so culturally there's a lot of barriers to them participating in any form of action. And I'm not just talking about going out the door on strike. I mean actually just wearing a badge on their jumper or having a sit in the tea room a bit longer. They are challenged with a whole lot of cultural things as well. So, for instance, I'm from Geelong and I was working in a factory down there where there was a lot of Italian workers at the time. This is in the early 80s. And the kettle broke, and so the delegate pulled stop work So off we go, and this was like 130 workers in this factory, and so off we go out the front, and the Italian women wouldn't move because the boss was Italian, and it was seen to go against their own, and so we had some challenges, and the way we moved those people, the way that we moved those other women workers was education. So meeting with them regularly, talking to them about what it means to be part of a collective, that it's not about going against an individual or the boss, it's about our basic rights in the workplace. I mean, it was a kettle, but still one of the cover. But, you know, I'll just touch on another thing. Like, in January of this year, I was in Sydney and I was in a boot factory, and majority of those women were Vietnamese background. There was no toilet paper in the toilets. When I spoke to the workers and said, well, what's going on here? And they said, oh, well, we'll bring our own.
Oh.
And so, obviously, I had a bit of a chat to the company. 2 weeks later, I went back and there was still no toilet paper in the toilets. So we had to take some quite severe action into getting that stopped and making sure that they were supplied with toilet paper on a regular basis. So our membership is got a lot of challenges about them being able to take action. We've tried a whole range of different strategies to be able to engage with women, empower women, but in different ways. So it depends on the workplace, depends on the number of workers that are in that workplace, depends on how much strength that they feel that they have, and it might start with very small steps. So it might be that they put a sticker on their locker. It might be that they wear a badge on their shirt. But then it slowly grows. But it has to start small for them to feel safe. So they've got to be able to feel safe that whatever they're encouraged to do, that their consequences aren't dire. But you've also got to remember they belong to bigger communities. And their boss may belong to that community as well. So we've got to look at the adverse effects, not just at work, but in their broader communities. And, you know, their partners in particular, and how that will impact on them in their home. So we've got to really think about how we do that in a much broader way. Some of the workers get really empowered, and we've got a real lot of out workers in particular, isolated workers that step up and have come to Senate inquiries with us and, you know, really gone to, you know, shop fronts and protested about low wages, etc., to the brands that they're working for. So there are pockets of people that still feel empowered regardless, but majority of people we've really got to take a much slower, softer approach. And that's not to say that eventually that we you know, we are hopeful that, you know, they, if there was a day of action, that they would participate. But it would be really difficult for a lot of them. And so I hope that if there is something that comes out of today about some sort of action, that it's able to be able to roll it out across all types of women, whether they can get to a particular rally or not, but that's inclusive of everyone.
I just want you all to answer just with one concept each. What's the main thing you want changed for working women in the future? So I know we could list a whole lot of things, but if you just give me one, what's the most pressing thing that you can think of? Nahid, we'll start with you.
Sure. So I think the main thing that I want to change very soon in the future for working women might be the kind of changing the political conversation that we as feminist union organizers and members have about inclusivity and women and the definition of feminism. So for me, as a result of, I think the depth of our conversation in union movement about having all the women included in the movement, we're kind of missing one very important point, which is refugee women who are stuck in camps in Nauru and Manus. I think if we want to do one thing very important and essential and to the basic, it's having, not just talking about and saying that we don't agree with the things that are happening, also proactively taking actions and campaigning to closing the camps and talking about refugee women and men in Nauru.
You answer next, just one, the main thing that you want to see change for working women in the future.
I want to build a female future leadership, because I think it is a very important thing, because it starts from the baby. So build a future leadership is because that is our future legacy for women, yeah. And people must understand that working women love the concern but not sympathy, recognized by the talent but not the gender.
I've been looking around the room trying to channel my colleagues, so I reckon I've got about 10 things written on my page here. Look, I'll take a very different tack to the previous speakers and say, in my industry, workload. That affects all of our members, but it affects our women members in particular ways as well. Our workloads are out of control across all of our sectors, and it means that we can't educate young people and adults in TAFE. We can't do that work as well as we would like to do it. And we all know, I think, in this room how important education is for the broader community, but in particular for women from all parts of our community. So we want to be able to provide the best education we can in our public education facilities, and workload is preventing us from doing that as well as we would like to do it.
Yeah, I suppose I touch a bit on education as well. I think for the migrant workers in our industry, I think education and empowerment would be something that I would really love to see happen.
I have a long list like Meredith as well, so it's like being asked to pick your favourite child, isn't it? But I think, on a practical note, nurses are practical. I think the right of entry legislation in the Fair Work Act is one of the critical things that we need to amend so that we can get access to our members, as well as, and then start the education and bring people along. And I think the decisions that have come from the Fair Work Commission in relation to the interpretation of the right of entry permits are pretty horrendous. And, you know, sometimes a bathroom can be deemed to be the suitable place to meet with people. And what you do on the farms when you don't have a bathroom, maybe that's a bit easier there. But so I think, you know, I think that's quite critical. You know, as a union official, I'm really not meant to go into a hospital without my right of entry permit and giving 24 hours notice and all of that palaver. And then I can only go to certain places where it's deemed to be appropriate and not disrupt the work or whatever. As a patient, I can wander around in my jammies at any hospital, which is a hard way to get access to your members if you have to go and try and access a bed. So I think a good starting point for us is our right of entry permits and being able to access people to actually have the conversations and to get people to join the union and to tell people about the union's issues and about, you know, the broader union issues. I think that's a good starting point for us.
A lot of food for thought for the rest of the day, and particularly for our workshops, in which we'll be contemplating some of what we've heard this morning and putting that into some kind of practice or plan for practice. So I'd like to thank everybody again for coming along. Nahid, Putri, Meredith, Beth and Lisa, if you could give them a round of applause.
That's it from the conference that was held March the 5th at the CFMEU offices, put together by the Women's Centre from the Victorian Trades Hall. They were posing the question, is it time for women to go on strike for equal pay, for share of the caring roles equally across society, and to declare enough is enough when it comes to workplace gendered violence?